quick disclaimer. This show is for educational and entertainment purposes only. We do not recommend or endorse any healthcare providers or treatments. The use of information presented on this podcast is at the listener's own risk. Please do your own research. This is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you are ill, do not delay seeking advice from your doctor. And finally, the views expressed by the hosts of this podcast do not represent the views of any official organization, hospital, or institution. Welcome to the External Medicine Podcast, where we explore ideas currently on the outskirts of medicine. I'm your host, Daniel Belkin. I'm a third-year medical student at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. I'm here with my co-host, Mitch Belkin, a third-year medical student at the, where do you go? The University of Maryland School of Medicine.
Hello.
Mitch, do we have any financial disclosures to make?
No.
That's a shame. All right. Today's interview is with Steve Kirsch. He is a tech entrepreneur and philanthropist. He holds a bachelor's of science and a master's of science in electrical engineering and computer science from MIT. He is currently the CEO of M10 and executive director of the COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund.
This interview was recorded on Sunday, January 31st, 2021. In this interview, we talk about why Steve founded the COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund. We spend some time exploring the antidepressant fluvoxamine as a potential treatment for COVID-19. And we close with why the CDC and physicians have been hesitant to endorse this medication, despite some persuasive clinical evidence of its efficacy. Stay tuned after our conversation with Steve for a summary and some closing thoughts. And now we bring you Steve Kirsch.
We are here with Steve Kirsch. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So could you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to start the COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund?
Sure. I'm a serial entrepreneur. I've started probably 7 or 8 high-tech companies. And when COVID hit, we were basically locked out of work. And I looked at the stats for myself and calculated that I had a pretty good chance of dying if I got COVID. So I had a kind of a enlightened self-interest here in solving this problem, to save my own life and to save other people's lives. So I looked around for stuff to do. And I talked to just a bunch of scientists that I funded for the past 20 years. And they all said that, repurposed drugs is the fastest and lowest cost way to end the pandemic. And you should always treat a virus early. And the third thing that they said is that the doctors who want to do this research and the drugs that are the most promising were not being funded. So I looked at that from an entrepreneur's point of view, we would call that a market opportunity. And so that's why I ended up starting the COVID Early Treatment Fund and raised $5 million, assembled a scientific advisory board of 12 top scientists and physicians, and then opened it up for grant applications. And we got over 60 grant applications and we funded 14. So that's the quick story.
Now, we want to talk a little bit more in depth about fluvoxamine, but before we do, can you tell us a little bit about some of the other drugs that you're currently looking into to treat COVID-19?
Sure. So we're funding a fluvoxamine inpatient study in France. So we're going to look at the drug fluvoxamine as well as the fluoxetine, which is a different drug. I mean, they sound alike.
And just so people understand what we're talking about, fluoxetine is the generic name for Prozac, and fluvoxamine is the generic name for Luvox. Both of these drugs are in a class called SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and they are a common treatment for anxiety, depression, OCD, and many other psychiatric conditions.
Exactly, yes. So we're going to look at that and do an inpatient study in France because all of the data we have is in outpatients. And we're pretty confident that it's going to work as well for inpatients as it does for outpatients, because it's an on-off switch for inflammation. It basically prevents the inflammatory storm on outpatients. And there's no reason that once you're admitted to the hospital that the drug would stop working. So we're funding this fluoxetine-fluoxamine inpatient study in France. Another project is Camistat. So we were the original sponsor for the Camistat study out of Yale, but it's recruiting too slowly. So we want to light a fire under the recruitment. And there are a number of things that we're applying to that problem, including resources that we can give the scientist that can track what his enrollments are and where the drop-offs are in the enrollment process so that he gets a much more efficient enrollment, which means we get to the answer faster. Because that there are, I think, about 40 people who have enrolled in that study over the last 4 or 5 months. And so that's going too slowly. There is a metformin study coming out of a University of Minnesota that we're funding, and that will look at, it's a 2x2 with metformin and fluvoxamine. It will test fluvoxamine at the lower dose, which is good because then we can see if metformin then has complementary effects. And the last drug I'll talk about is GS441524. We have funded their research on that drug. It's a precursor for remdesivir, and we think it's the safer, cheaper, easier to make cousin of remdesivir. It should be given early, and the nice thing, it can be, we figured out a way to give it in pill form so people can just, they get COVID, they swallow this, and because it's an antiviral, we're done. You know, it's kind of like this, one and done, and it's not going to be one pill, but it may be like one pill a day. Very low side effect profiles. We're also looking at ciproheptadine, which is given to later stage patients, and possibly a fluvoxetine trial in Zambia. So, you know, those are some of the activities that we're involved in.
So, Steve, I want to talk more about fluvoxamine. And before we get into the discussion, you have a great resource, repository, slideshow online, which everyone should look at. It has a lot of evidence for using fluvoxamine in treating COVID-19, and it goes through some of the observational studies and the Washington University randomized control trial that was published in JAMA in November. We're going to link to that on our website, externalmedicinepodcast.com, and it's also on your website. But before we get into the trials, can you tell us why they even did the trials? Like, why was fluvoxamine thought of as a drug that was worthy of further investigation in treating COVID-19?
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, fluvoxamine is a common antidepressant. It was one of the original SSRI antidepressants invented 37 years ago. The reason that it was chosen here is that it strongly activates the sigma-1 receptor. And this is a critical receptor that if you activate it, then sort of there's a chain of events that happens that then can lead to the inhibition of inflammation. So there was a... there are a bunch of things that led to this. The people at Washington University, they were actually guided by a University of Virginia study. But what was interesting is that there was evidence from France. People noticed in a Paris mental hospital, for example, that patients who got the drug had a third the incidence of severe COVID as the staff. So how come the mental institution patients were protected and the staff was not?
Now, were those patients getting a bunch of different antidepressants and antipsychotics, or were they?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they were, right? They were getting a bunch of different antidepressants. But then that led to, so this is in May. This is basically in the psych ward at the St. Anne Hospital in Paris. It was a 14% severe forms of COVID versus 4% in the patients in the psych ward. So they thought, man, that's a factor of three. There's something going on here, right? What's protecting these psych patients? So it was like, holy shit, you know, a factor of three reduction, that is huge. So there was an observational study done by Nicolas Hortel in France, and they looked at 7,345 patients who were on antidepressants, and they showed that all of the SSRIs were statistically significant protection against COVID. And it turned out that some SSRIs were way more protective than others, but they didn't know the reason because they never thought of looking at the sigma-1 activation. But when I read that paper, I looked at the sigma-1, I'm an engineer, I looked at the sigma-1 activation of each of these drugs, and lo and behold, the protective order was exactly correlated with the amount of sigma-1 activation. And I'm using the analysis in the latest paper, which I'm not sure has been published, but it's available in that online repository. So people can look at it and you can verify what I just said. And fluvoxamine wasn't included in the analysis because only one person was hospitalized who took fluvoxamine. And this was a study that looked at what was the protection against intubation and death rather than protection against hospitalization. So, because this was all inpatients where they did this analysis. But they found out that half the benefit, basically, you know, a 50% reduction came from the SSRI nature of the drug. But the other half of the benefit, so it gets you down to a hazard ratio of 0.26, is this sigma-1 agonist property of the drug. So if you're highly activating sigma-1, of which fluoxetine, aka Prozac, will do, then you get it even, you know, sort of the other 50%. So you get a 75% reduction in risk if you're essentially, the SSRI gave you 50%, you got another 50% for sigma-1, and now you're at a 75% reduction. And there are other mechanisms as well, including the fact that both fluoxetine and fluvoxamine are potent phiasmas, and so that gives you an antiviral benefit. And we don't know how to quantify those benefits individually, right, because the drug has basically eight different mechanisms. But it was pretty clear. I mean, there was a German study as well, and that's summarized on the site. And the German study looked at what comorbidities protected people from fatality. And so if you had depression as a comorbidity, you were very statistically significant, you know, p-value 0.003. You were protected against fatality by, I mean, the effect size wasn't huge, it was like 25%, but still, you know, that's overall depression as a whole, meaning SSRIs plus non-SSRI drugs. And so if you just limited it to SSRIs, you would find a bigger effect and so forth. So this like popped out of the page. It's like the only comorbidity in this German study where you saw this kind of effect. The effect size was 36% reduction over depression as a whole group. So you can imagine that if you're just going with SSRIs, that you're going to have an even larger effect size. Completely different study done in Germany. So everything is aligned on this drug in terms of the supporting research and the observational studies. And so I looked at the LENS study that was published in JAMA, as icing on the cake and saying, yep, it confirms what we knew from the observational studies. And then, of course, the CEFTEL real world evidence study that will be published Monday in OFID journal as editor's choice that further confirmed 100% effect size of protecting against hospitalization and death. Well, I mean, basically hospitalization and long-term COVID, because nobody died. Well, I mean, one person died in the placebo group, so, you know, it protected against death as well in that study. So,
Steve, could you please tell us about Eric Lenz's study in JAMA and David Seftel's open label trial?
Sure. So we sponsored the Lenz trial out of Wash U to study fluvoxamine. And they ran it as a remote trial. So people would have to report in. It was no direct contact with the investigators. And it was published in JAMA out of, you know, selected out of 10,000 papers. It's had like 160,000 views on JAMA. It was like one of the top articles that month that it appeared in November 12th. People who took fluvoxamine, there was a 0% hospitalization rate. There was one guy who did get hospitalized, but was for dehydration because he had diarrhea before he got into the study. There were no significant adverse events related to the drug. If you took fluvoxamine in the no treatment group, there were 72. Hospitalization death rate was 8.3%, and the significant adverse effects were 6. So there's night and day difference between those. I mean, if we label these drugs as drug A and drug B, nobody would take drug B, which is the placebo. I mean, it's not even a close call. And then the day that study was published, the very day, there was a massive COVID outbreak at Golden Gate Fields. And the physician at Golden Gate Fields, who had been there for 10 years, happened to read the JAMA study and said, hey, I got a massive COVID outbreak. I'm going to give this thing a shot. What he found was that everybody who took the drug, it was a zero hospitalization and death rate. Of 77 people who took the drug, zero hospitalization death rate. There was zero long hauler symptoms, meaning after 2 weeks, none of the people had any of the long hauler symptoms. And whereas you compare that with the people who refused the drug because they said, I don't need it, I'm healthy, I'm low risk at getting side effects, what happened was a 12.5% actual hospitalization rate. And 60% of them had one or more long hauler symptoms after 2 weeks. So it's 60% compared to zero. And 29% of them had four or more long hauler symptoms after 2 weeks. So, I mean, that's like night and day difference. And so after he started offering the drug to people, the reason it's so lopsided, 77 in the fluvoxamine group and 48 in the no treatment group, is that when people realized what was happening to their friends, everybody, 100% of the people, because only 40% opted in and said, yeah, I trust you, I'll take the drug. Most people were skeptical. 60% said no way. And 2 weeks later, 100% went for the drug. And people were asking it proactively, going in and saying, I want this drug. And even people in the no treatment group who weren't getting the drug said, hey, changed my mind. And great. So they were counted in the treatment group. Because, you know, this is not a formalized RCT, so we could do that. And so we got the harder cases, right? We got the people who kind of failed at the staying home and weren't having a good time. They switched over, and all 8 people who switched over were turned around within a few days. So that the 77 is a worse than randomized cohort. And so the p-value of that was 0.0026. So you've got 2 studies now with p-value of 0.01 or lower. And the effect size, according to the Fisher-Exact test, is a 75%. there's a 95% confidence interval is 75% effect size or better. And the physicians that the doctors that know the drug the best think that the effect size is probably around 80%.
Steve, the side effects of fluvoxamine in Harrison's Manual of Medicine include headache, nausea, insomnia, sexual dysfunction. And this is pretty common with all SSRIs. I know that in the two studies that we've been talking about, some of the patients were treated with a low dose of 50 milligrams twice daily, which could account for a lower side effect profile. I just want to make the best case against using fluvoxamine. What would you say is the best case against using fluvoxamine for COVID?
I've never heard of it, any case where fluvoxamine made anything worse. I've never heard of if you gave someone fluvoxamine that they died, you know. So I think the a friend of mine said, well, if the FDA gives an EUA for this, the problem is that people will then let down their guard, they will take their masks off, and we will end up having a greater spread. And therefore, more people will die. If you give them a drug which is, say, 80% effective, people will drop their guard. And my response to that is, yeah, you're right. But the people who then do get infected will all know about the drug because everybody knew about the drug, because that's why everybody changed their behavior. And they'll just take the drug. And the drug basically defangs the virus. It turns this very dangerous coronavirus into a coronavirus that is non-harmful. And so this particular coronavirus variant happens to be very dangerous. Giving the drug basically, you know, hits the kill switch on the inflammatory response. It doesn't do a lot for the in terms of an antiviral, but it turns off the virus's ability to do damage. And that is really what makes the difference here.
So you're not a physician. You do have a background in science. So what would you say to someone who is skeptical about taking advice from someone who isn't a doctor?
Well, I would say that you should evaluate people on what they say and the facts and whether what they're telling you is the truth or not. And so doctors can give you very bad advice, and engineers can give you very good advice, and vice versa. And, you know, really, it's your own health, and you should look at what's being presented to you and make a call based on the evidence at hand. And so for that reason, I put together a very comprehensive repository of data on fluvoxamine. And people can look at the data, at the original data, and make up their own minds. And you know, there's some arguments from me, and there's some summary data from me on how I would summarize that. The important thing is that I'm just bringing it to people's attention, and they should evaluate the evidence based on the quality of the evidence rather than who the messenger is. And I know that may be hard for some people, right? Because if I'll give you a perfect example. Dr. Fauci, you know, he's never talked about fluvoxamine. And he, in fact, his boss recently said, well, we probably won't have repurposed drugs. This is Francis Collins saying we won't have repurposed drugs for sometime next year. Okay, so those guys are the experts. Well, the NIH is the expert, right, on ivermectin. And they say, well, it's kind of, we're not going to recommend it, or we're not going to not recommend it. We're just going to give sort of no opinion on ivermectin. Okay, so those are the experts. Now, if you listen to the experts, right, the CDC is the experts. If you listen to them, then it's guaranteed that 90,000 people will die over the next 3 weeks, because that's what the CDC has said. They have said that if you listen to our advice and follow it, 90,000 of you will die. And that is really tragic. And so, you know, I will tell you that if you listen to my advice, I can't give out medical advice because I'm not a doctor and we don't have a doctor-patient relationship, but I can tell you what I would do if I was diagnosed with COVID. is I would rush. In fact, I already have. I mean, I've already talked to my doctor. My doctor has already prescribed fluoxamine for me so that if I got any COVID symptoms, I can immediately start taking the drug 50 milligrams twice a day for 14 days. And because I know what happens, I've seen the evidence over and over and over again that this drug works. And in Dr. Seftel's study, what he found, the biggest complaint was that people said, why can't I get back to work? I'm feeling fine. And, you know, how often do you have that in a COVID patient? And other people have shown me anecdotal evidence, meaning, hey, let me show you this guy's chart here. This is an intubated patient who is given fluvoxamine. And what happens is their CRP starts going down and down and down and down and down till it gets to baseline, you know, baseline meaning before they got COVID. And then the doctors are forced to remove the drug. So they have to take away the fluvoxamine. And the reason they have to do that is because they were given a 15-day authorization to give the drug. So they remove the fluvoxamine, and then the patient immediately turns around, and you know, the CRP scores go up and up and up, and 5 days later, this patient is dead. So you have a drug which, when you give it, the CRP goes down, and when you take it away, the CRP goes up. And you know, if they had more time, they could have repeated that over and over and over and would have gotten the same result. And still, of course, nobody would believe it. You know, and but these are, you know, anecdotes. But the point is that the in Seftel's case, he had 77 patients and he could see the turnaround in every single one of those 77 patients. So, hey, you don't have to believe me. You can check with Dr. Seftel. So I'm just the messenger.
Now, I just want to explain CRP. So CRP is C-reactive protein, which is a protein that is made by the liver, and it tends to increase as inflammation in the body goes up. And it's actually been known to be correlated with the severity of COVID, just so people know what CRP is. So I know you have to go soon. So my last question is, why is it that fluvoxamine isn't currently recommended by the CDC? And why is it that so few doctors are using it in a clinical setting?
Okay, so those are two different questions. The reason doctors shy away from it is because doctors don't like doing anything new that's untested. They don't like to be cowboys and take risks. And very few doctors have experience with fluvoxamine, even the psychiatrists. It turns out that when you ask the psychiatrist, you know, what about this drug? And he said, yeah, no problem. You know, I've prescribed 10,000 patients with SSRIs at many times that dose and you know, without any problems whatsoever. And so it's what you're comfortable with. And so the doctors haven't prescribed SSRIs before. So they're uncomfortable with it. They go to the FDA website and it says all of these problems that you're going to have, you know, all of these, you know, hey, here are the risk factors, you know, you could get diarrhea or you could get nausea, you could get da 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 da. And, you know, those things are like just super rare events. And when you're taking the drug at 1/3 of the dose that was used there, and you're only taking it for 14 days, the list of negative events goes like down and down and down and down to, you know, near zero. And so if you compare the sort of the risk of adverse effects versus the, you know, even if you had a 0.1% risk of dying from COVID, there is absolutely no comparison here. So they're not doing the math. No, none of these doctors who say, I'm not going to do this has ever come, come to the website to research it. They don't have time to do that. They look to the CDC. So the CDC won't take action on this because the CDC looks at what is the, what can be used for clinical practice. And clinical practice guidelines always say, oh, you have to have a large RCT. That is the rule. You have to have, you know, the small phase two and a large phase three, or we're not going to consider you for any kind of change in the practice guidelines. And that's the rules. And but it doesn't mean that I think the FDA can in fact issue an EUA and should issue an EUA immediately for this drug, because it saves lives. We're losing 30,000 people a week, or 20 to 30,000 people a week. There is no reason to wait. And so it, once there's an EUA, then the doctor should talk to their patients and consult with them and say, hey, you know, we have the evidence of success here. What do you want to do? And here is the evidence. And it's known as shared decision-making. And so doctors should engage in shared decision-making with fluvoxamine. They can do that right now. They don't have to wait for an EUA, but the EUA will give them sort of the cover of, yes, see, the FDA says it's okay. So you can trust me. So the doctors don't have to be off the reservation when they're prescribing this.
Steve, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to chat with us. Before you go, is there any other final thoughts or words that you would like to relay on this topic?
Yeah, for people who want information, I posted just a bunch of stuff and opinion pieces, and why aren't people writing about this? It's all on my website. It's skirsch.io, and the repository that we talked about is there as well.
So, Daniel, what are your thoughts on fluvoxamine?
I think that there's a reasonable case to be made for using fluvoxamine to treat COVID-19.
What would you say the best case is in favor of fluvoxamine?
So, first of all, there are all of those European studies, the observational ones earlier in the pandemic, which show that there's some sort of relationship between SSRI use and either less severe COVID infections or fewer COVID infections. Also, we didn't have a chance to go into this in great depth during the interview, but there are studies which show a mechanism of action for SSRIs and specifically fluvoxamine on inflammation. From my understanding, a lot of the damage that's done by COVID-19 is actually not done by the virus itself. It's actually done by the body's response to the virus. It causes a lot of inflammation, and then that leads to a lot of the problems. And the way that I think about this is that an immune cell in the body detects either a virus or a pathogen, or it just gets really stressed out. It alerts all of its neighbors, and it causes this like sort of cascade of inflammation between immune cells and other cells in the body. And the way that a cell signals another cell that it's stressed out is using a protein called a cytokine. And Steve mentioned that fluvoxamine has a sigma-1 agonist property similar to other SSRIs.
That is sigma as in the Greek letter sigma.
Yeah, sigma as in the Greek letter 1 receptor. It's a
one as in the number 1.
Yes, 1 is in the number 1. And it's a receptor, a chaperone protein at the endoplasmic reticulum inside those immune cells. And when it gets activated, as it can be by fluvoxamine or other SSRIs, it functions as an inhibitor of cytokines. It says, we're gonna turn these cytokines either off or way down, and it essentially decreases inflammation. And if what I said is before is true, that most of the damage done by COVID-19 is through the inflammatory cascade, then fluvoxamine is gonna dampen that. So that's a good thing. Another mechanism that we didn't have time to go into in this interview is that SSRIs are actually associated with an anticoagulative effect, and they may inhibit platelets. So if you're a COVID-positive patient, and many people may already know this, COVID-positive patients have a propensity to form blood clots. And if fluvoxamine and other SSRIs can decrease blood clot formation, that would be a good effect on top of the anti-inflammatory effects. And then there's all of the clinical trial evidence. Do you want to try and summarize that for us?
Sure, Daniel. The clinical trial evidence boils down to two main studies. And we talked with Steve about this. So there's the Eric Len study conducted at WashU. That's the randomized phase 2 placebo-controlled trial. And then there is David Seftel's open label trial.
In the LENS study, they took 152 patients who had SARS-CoV-2 positive tests within the past 7 days. Everybody in this study had an oxygen saturation of greater than 92%, and the patients were randomized either to get a placebo or fluvoxamine for 15 days. The dose, they started at 50 milligrams twice daily, and they worked their way up to 300 milligrams daily, provided that they were able to tolerate that dose. So there were 72 patients in the placebo group and 80 patients in the fluvoxamine group. Everyone was monitored for what they term clinical deterioration. And they define that as either shortness of breath or hospitalization for pneumonia or shortness of breath. Alternatively, an oxygen saturation of less than 92% on room air was also deterioration. Six of the 72 patients in the placebo group had clinical deterioration. So that's 8.7%, with 95% confidence interval between 1.8 and 16.4%. In the fluvoxamine group, on the other hand, zero of the 80 patients had clinical deterioration, so 0%. In Seftal's open label clinical trial of fluvoxamine, there were 113 patients, and they chose whether or not they wanted to receive fluvoxamine 50 milligrams twice daily or nothing. And in the group that received nothing, the observation group, six of the 48 were hospitalized, two ended up in the ICU, and one of those two died. So that's 12.5% of the patients were hospitalized. In the fluvoxamine group, none of the 65 patients were hospitalized, none ended up in the ICU, and none of them died. So the p-value, they didn't report confidence intervals for this, but the p-value difference was 0.005, which exceeds the arbitrary 0.05 p-value for statistical significance.
Should we explain p-value?
Sure, Daniel. I'll let you give that a crack.
I wanted you to say no. No, so a p-value for anyone listening is basically, in a world in which there was no difference between the two groups, so in a world in which the drug does nothing, this is the chance that you would see a result this extreme or greater.
You're saying this result by pure chance alone?
Yes.
Getting back on track, after 14 days, of the 65 patients in the fluvoxamine group, zero of them had symptoms. On the contrary, 60% of the patients in the placebo group had long hauler symptoms. I think Steve used that term. And what that means is that they had persistent COVID symptoms, such as body aches, muscle or joint pain, difficulty concentrating, fatigue, headache, insomnia, diarrhea, dizziness, chills, shortness of breath. And that was measured at 14 days in.
Yeah. So basically, if you were in the fluvoxamine group, you didn't have any long-term symptoms of COVID, and at least at 14 days. And if you were in the do nothing, take nothing group, 60% of people had something 14 days later. Now, we have to keep in mind that this wasn't a randomized control trial. And although the groups in the fluvoxamine group and the taking nothing group, they were relatively similar with respect to age and gender and chronic comorbidity, at least when you lump all those chronic comorbidities together, they had similar levels. I think there was a difference between hypertension and diabetes in the two groups, that the no treatment group had higher hypertension and the fluvoxamine group had higher diabetes.
Yeah. And I think just building off of that, one point that Steve made was, because this was an open label trial, the initial patients, a lot larger percentage, opted for nothing. And when later on patients saw how the people in the fluvoxamine group had done better, you had later on patients, a larger percentage of them were going out of their way to ask for fluvoxamine. So, you know, they only categorize three different chronic comorbidities: lung disease, diabetes, hypertension. you can imagine that later on in the trial, more people with more of these comorbidities may have opted into the fluvoxamine group rather than the placebo group because it was not randomized and not blinded.
Yeah. Another point is that the fluvoxamine group had more patients who identified as Latinos and more people with mild or moderate COVID symptoms at baseline, whereas the no treatment group had a lot more asymptomatic people at baseline. So just on the surface, I think one might expect, just based on the demographics and the symptoms, that the fluvoxamine group might actually do worse. But instead, in the trial, they ended up doing a lot better. The only case I can really make in my head against this is that it wasn't randomized. So there might be some like healthy user bias involved here, but—
Can you please explain what the healthy user bias is, Daniel?
Sure. The healthy user bias is that someone who chooses a treatment is more likely to be doing other things in addition to the treatment that might make them healthier. So good behaviors and bad behaviors tend to clump together. So if you're looking at people who, people who exercise are five times less likely to get this bad disease, is it the exercise or is it all of the other things that someone who is more prone to exercise is also going to be doing? So that's a healthy user bias. But I guess this can take us into like, what is your best case against taking fluvoxamine?
So I think that the strongest argument against fluvoxamine is that there was only one randomized placebo-controlled trial, and that's the LEND study. And, you know, it was only 152 people. That's a relatively small cohort. On top of that, you know, they were only followed for 15 days. So you could easily argue we really don't have enough gold standard evidence to recommend fluvoxamine yet. The obvious analogy here is hydroxychloroquine from earlier in the pandemic. A lot of people were very, very excited about that drug early on. And there was some preliminary data which looked promising, but later studies showed it to be rather disappointing. You know, if I'm making the best case against using fluvoxamine, I would say I'd want to see a larger randomized control trial in order to see what this medication looks like on a larger number of patients from multiple different centers. And I'd also want to see some follow-up. What were these patients doing at 1 month, 2 months, 4 months, et cetera?
And in terms of side effects, we spoke a little bit about side effects in the interview. I know that there weren't too many people who had side effects in the two clinical trials, but from what I've seen, there's some data suggesting that up to about a quarter of people who take fluvoxamine end up getting nausea. Here, let's pull up UpToDate. You can read what it has to say about like toxicity and stuff.
So here's what UpToDate has to say. Fluvoxamine is generally safe in overdose. In a poison center study of 299 fluvoxamine ingestions, toxicity was benign when the dose ingested was less than 1,000 milligrams. Common symptoms of mild to moderate ingestions were drowsiness, tremor, diarrhea, vomiting, abdominal pain, dizziness, mydriasis, and sinus tachycardia. At higher doses, there were 5 seizures reported, as well as deeper levels of sedation, hypokalemia, hypotension, sinus bradycardia, never requiring treatment, and repolarization disorders. 13 deaths were reported, but they could all be attributed to co-ingestants or other medical problems. Among the 55 patients in whom fluvoxamine was the sole ingestant, only mild to moderate symptoms were evident, and the authors concluded that isolated overdoses of fluvoxamine rarely cause severe toxicity.
So I guess the question is, Mitch, would you take fluvoxamine if you got COVID-19?
I think that you really need to look at this from a cost-benefit perspective, and I think there's a pretty reasonable case to be made for using fluvoxamine if you have COVID-19 and you aren't taking any other contraindicated medications. It's a relatively safe drug, and you know it's been approved for use in the US since the early 1990s. Because of that, we have a good gauge on the safety profile, and I trust a safety profile of a drug that's 30 years old over a newly developed drug. I think another important point to make is that psychiatrists and family medicine doctors prescribe similar SSRIs like fluoxetine or Prozac and Lexapro or escitalopram all the time. Fluvoxamine is in the same risk category as those medications. And like all medications, there are risks. But assuming you're not taking any other SSRIs or medications that could interact with fluvoxamine, those risks seem relatively low to me.
Yeah. By contrast, the risks associated with getting COVID-19 could be substantial. So, I mean, there's going to be a difference between an 80-year-old and a 20-year-old getting COVID. But according to Our World and Data, the case fatality rate for someone over 80 is 13 to 20%. That's a 13 to 20% chance of dying. Mind you, it's a case fatality rate, so it likely overestimates the probability, but still it's a lot. Someone in their 20s, it's much lower. It's more like 0.2% or 2 in 1,000. But you know, 2 in 1,000 risk of dying seems higher than many, or at least I would necessarily want to encounter. Also, we still don't know about a lot of the long-term COVID effects. So irreversible lung damage or other complications are I think more serious for some, or more of a serious consideration for someone who's younger. It's one thing if you're going to die. I mean, that's maybe not as big of a deal for someone who's in their early 20s and invincible, but you know, having long-term lung damage or, you know, still not being the same, still having difficulties concentrating or thinking or having headaches years later, or even a year later, that's something that I might be concerned about.
I think another important point to make here is that there is a phase 3 clinical trial of fluvoxamine that's currently going on at WashU. I think there are also a couple other sites, if I'm not mistaken. And they started recruitment in December 2020, and they're expected to finish the study sometime between July and September of this year. They're going to have about 1,100 patients. But in the meantime, between now and sometime between July and September, there are going to be a lot of people who will die from COVID. So while the benefits of fluvoxamine have not been confirmed in a phase 3 clinical trial, personally, I'd be willing to take the risks of the medicine not working for the possibility that the drug is even half or a quarter as effective as it appears. And I think that a lot of that is simply because the evidence makes me say there could be a there. And, you know, I could be wrong, absolutely. But personally, I don't take any contraindicated meds, and you know, I'd be willing to risk a little nausea or sexual dysfunction.
All right. Well, that's all I wanted to say about fluvoxamine. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think we've gone on for long enough.
All right. Well, goodbye, Mitch.
If you'd like to support us, here are some ways you can help. Subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review, preferably a phenomenal review. Visit us at externalmedicinepodcast.com and tell your friends.